On the Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is the Murder Squad.
A newlywed couple still enjoying the first year of marriage chooses to live in the great outdoors. The two alternate between campsites in Moab, Utah. On August 13th, they go out for drinks with friends at a local bar. They tell their friends about a creepy guy who's been camping next to them.
The two women are so intimidated by the man, one tells their friends, "If something happens to us, we were murdered." Then they aren't seen again. Their bodies are discovered near their campsite almost a week later. For a brief moment, the case was possibly linked to the high-profile missing persons case of Gabby Pepito. But even with the increased attention, their killer remains unknown. Our job, to find the killer of Crystal Turner and Kylene Schulte.
This is the Murder Squad. Oh, so Billy, you're back in your velvety room.
I'm back in the velvety room, and we have an update.
Oh.
A lot of people have been writing in. You know, last week we recorded this, a week ahead of time, but last week there was a lot of true crime news. And one of the biggest things that popped up was an arrest in the Faith Hedgepeth case.
Yeah.
Now, in season one, episode 14, we covered the murder of Faith Hedgepeth in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And this was a story that I originally was working on. I handed it off, and me and Kelly McClear was working on it, who's been a guest on the show. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot on Crime Watch Daily on it. We were actually working on potentially doing a side podcast on it as well. So she was murdered on September 7, 2012. Faith went out to a club with her roommate around 1 a.m. and they left the club a little after 2 a.m. Her roommate was picked up at 4:30 a.m. by friends. And when she returned home at 11, she discovered Faith had been murdered. She was on her bed with a pool of blood under her head, and she had been beaten and raped. And for years, the case focused a lot on the roommate and those who Faith were with that night. But after 9 years, an arrest was finally made. 28-year-old Miguel Enrique Salcedo Olivares was taken into custody. A press conference was held after the arrest, and during the press conference, law enforcement said Olivares' DNA matched DNA from the crime scene. He is currently being held without bond, and we're going to keep watching these developments closely and keep you updated with Gabby Pepito, and we're going to be talking about her and the whole idea of the missing white woman syndrome, trying to get more focus on missing and murdered Indigenous women, and that was what Faith was. So so glad that we were able to get some answers to this one.
Yeah, be interesting to see what the suspects relationship, if any, was to Faith. Why was he there? Was there a relationship? Was this a stranger attack? Did he have any dealings with the apartment complex where Faith was murdered? So that I'm highly interested to find out more about him, that those details will come out, I'm sure.
Yeah. So we're going to be staying on this, and we will, because this was one of the very first cases that we did and brought to you. So we're going to be staying on this and keeping you up to date. But for now, we're going to go to Moab, Utah.
Kylene Schulte was originally from Billings, Montana, but after being in an abusive relationship, she shut down. She was experiencing suicidal thoughts. Her father, Sean Paul, convinced her to move to Moab, Utah with him. It's a move she later told her dad had saved her life. Sean Paul and Kylene were on a hike in 2019 when they met Crystal Turner. The two women bonded with both loving the outdoors. It was after that chance meeting Sean Paul saw a difference in Kylene. According to the Salt Lake City Tribune, Sean Paul said Kylene started blossoming. Their bond over nature extended to a full-out love for each other. In April of 2021, the couple married in a treehouse in Crystal's home state of Arkansas. When they got back home to Moab, a town of 5,200 people, they went back to work. Kylene worked at the Moonflower Cooperative. Crystal worked at the McDonald's on Main Street. But in August of 2021, she was planning to start a new job at the Trailhead Public House, a tavern across the street from the grocery store where Kylene worked. The couple had three vehicles, a 1987 Econoline van, a Kia Sorento, and a Harley Davidson. The van was usually parked at the McDonald's where Crystal worked. The Kia was with the women wherever they went camping, and if they left town, the Harley went with them. In August of 2021, they were living and camping in the LaSalle Mountains. The area is a popular tourist location right outside of the Arches National Park.
On August 13th, the couple went out to Woody's Tavern on Main Street to meet up with friends. They arrived at 6 p.m. Crystal and Kylene enjoyed the drinks and conversation, but during the night, the couple told their friends about a creepy guy that was staying next to them. They said he intimidated them, and Kylene even told her friends, like we said at the top of the episode, if something happens to us, we were murdered. Crystal and Kylene left Woody's Tavern around 9:30 p.m. It's thought that they returned to their campsite, or possibly went to go find a new one. But then they didn't show up to their shifts at work. And their families knew they wouldn't just miss work. On August 15th, they reported the women missing to the Grand County Sheriff's Office. According to the Tribune, the sheriffs didn't investigate. It was believed the 24-year-old and 38-year-old woman may have just left on their own. But Crystal and Kylene's friends knew better. And they were even more certain when the women's Harley-Davidson motorcycle was still parked in town. They would never have left that behind. So we've talked about this a ton of not taking things seriously, not taking missing persons reports seriously. You have a family and friends saying, this is not the case. They would never not do this. And then you have a law enforcement agency that's saying, this is a camping situation. People move around all the time. There's no fixed address. So we're not going to investigate this like we would if there was a fixed address and somebody didn't come home.
Yeah. You know, and I think this is where law enforcement needs to learn. You know, they have to be able to assess the details of what's being presented to them. You know, and when the family and friends are able to provide details such as this Harley Davidson, you know, this is something where it's like, okay, this is not normal. This is a red flag versus we don't know where he's at. He disappears all the time, which is the typical type of missing persons report that law enforcement gets without a lot of those articulable facts, you know, to say this is the reason this is different. But here they're coming and saying this is different. This is not like them. This is where law enforcement needs to now pay attention and let's put some resources behind this earlier than later.
Yeah, because especially you have the friends saying, you know, that they had this creepy guy there. There were early reports that said they may have been followed from the bar, but the bar swears that no one followed them out of the bar. But it was a cause for concern because you had three big things there. You had them saying there was a creepy guy. You had them leaving the motorcycle, and then you had them not showing up for work.
Yeah.
So if you got those three things, you should take it seriously.
Absolutely. With no movement from the police, Kylene's dad called his friend Cindy Sue Hunter on the 17th. He expressed his frustration. Sean Paul had moved back to Montana and couldn't search for the women. Cindy promised she'd go and look for them first thing in the morning. Cindy's first stop in the morning was by the Econoline van parked at the McDonald's. She looked inside but didn't see the women. She then went to look for their campsite. She called Sean Paul in between. He told her Crystal and Kylene were planning on moving their site because of a creeper dude. Cindy continued to look for the campsite. She made it to the South Mesa area of the LaSalle Loop Road. Eventually, she found it through the trees and down a tricky little side road. Just as she began to look through the site, she saw Kylene's body. She called the police.
Grand County sheriffs arrived on the scene. The Kia Sorento was present, along with their tent and camping items and this little makeshift rabbit shelter with their pet rabbit inside. Close to the site in a nearby creek were Crystal and Kylene's bodies. Both women had suffered multiple gunshot wounds to the back, sides, and or chest. Neither were dressed below the waist. According to a search warrant later served, one of the women was wearing a bra that had been pushed up towards her neck, and the other was only wearing a tank top. And the warrant doesn't specify which victim these details belong to. But what we're seeing here, and we don't have all of the information. We don't even know if it was the same gun or not. But we've got two women partially undressed, shot multiple times each in a campsite that was difficult to discover. And there's been no time of death that has been released, likely to have been killed probably the last night they were seen or sometime in between because they didn't show up to work. So we're looking at right after they had come back from the bar.
Yeah. You know, it obviously this appears to be a sexually motivated crime. You know, the location is something in which now you have a limited number of people that are going to be going back there. And so this starts to suggest that this may have been somebody who was at an adjacent campsite or had familiarity with the area, possibly somebody that followed them. You know, if they're leaving the bar and somebody followed them from the bar. But it definitely, when they're a suspect following them from the bar would have no clue that they're necessarily going to be going to this campsite. So if the suspect follows them and sees, oh, they've isolated themselves, now he takes advantage of the situation. Two victims, you know, it's hard to control two adults, but you have a gun. And we don't know how many guns were used, as you brought up, but a gun is the ultimate controlling mechanism. You know, a person with a gun can control a crowd. So for me, at this point, we can't eliminate the possibility of multiple offenders, but there still is the possibility that this is just a single offender controlling both these women.
And it's still not clear from what I've been able to find out if they had moved their campsite. Because if they were at drinks with their friends and they told their friends, we're probably going to move our campsite, there's a real creeper guy there. They leave the bar at 9:30. It's already, even though it's the summer, it's already dark.
Yeah.
Moving a campsite in the dark is extremely difficult. And you're also tired. You've had a couple drinks. You're not going to want to do that. So it sounds like maybe they stayed at the same campsite, but I'm not quite sure yet. If anybody knows that information, please reach out to us.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, you know, were there other campers in the area, you know, witnesses, so to speak, that may have seen, you know, not only the victims, but this creeper dude, you know, yeah. and get a description. After the discovery, Grand County Sheriff's Office said that they believe there is no current danger to the public. Then on August 19th, they served a search warrant on the couple's Econoline van. It was still parked at McDonald's. According to the search warrant, the vehicle was unlawfully acquired and has been used or is possessed for the purpose of being used to commit or conceal the commission or an offense or evidence of illegal conduct. Inside the van was a black journal. It held newspaper clippings, miscellaneous mail, and pay stubs for Crystal, Kylan, and Kylan's dad. There was a Bible, notes with phone numbers, and other information. And there was a damaged black Samsung Galaxy 8 phone. Also inside was drug paraphernalia, an electronic scale, a glass pipe, a small plastic container. All of them had residue on them. There are also pills in the van, 10 clonazepam, 13 ibuprofens, 9 amoxicillin, and 1.5 tablets of prednisone.
So, Paul, we have the warrant. We're able to get a copy of the warrant. And the warrant was released to the media very soon, which is kind of odd. What sticks out to you from it?
Well, you know, I think, you know, first and foremost is understanding the location of this vehicle. It's on a public property at McDonald's, but this is where the registered owners, which were the victims, would normally leave this vehicle. So in terms of assessing, well, was this vehicle stolen or not? It doesn't appear that it was stolen because it's where it was expected to be. You know, taking a look at the warrant, the investigator, you know, writes to the courts that he is wanting to search this vehicle for any and all items that would or may lead to the identification, apprehension, and arrest of an individual or individuals involved in the death of the two victims. And then he details, I'm looking for, you know, but not limited to photos, identifications, maps, notes, diaries, pay stubs, electronic communication devices, etc. So he is thinking that at this point, and this is an appropriate way to think about it, is that, well, is it possible that the victims had previously interacted with their killer? And so now he's looking for indicia. He's looking for names. He's looking for dates. He's looking for things, you know, like photos that might have, you know, show the killer. In addition, I hope that they process the vehicle for latents and DNA if they think the killer was physically present in the vehicle. So he is focusing not on the vehicle. It's not that this warrant is indicating that this vehicle stole it. He's saying, okay, I want to seize evidence that will help me investigate this case. Now, the odd thing, and I had to look this up, is the language, you know, was unlawfully acquired or unlawfully possessed, had been used or is possessed for the purpose of, you know, being to conceal the commission of an offense or evidence of illegal conduct. Well, in Utah, you know, every state has their own criteria for what a peace officer has to be able to tell a magistrate as to why they will violate somebody's Fourth Amendment protection rights, you know, about illegal search and seizure. Mm-hmm. And so out of Rule 40 in Utah, this is language straight out of that statute. So every search warrant, I imagine, in Utah has this language in it in order to say, hey, I need these items to investigate the case. And so that's what he says initially. But also, this property or evidence is satisfying the statute for me to be able to seize it as at your orders, magistrate, as a peace officer, in order to be able to advance the case. It's confusing when you hear it sort of out of context, but when you look at the search warrant under the context of the statute within Utah, it makes absolute sense. And every state has this kind of criteria that the courts require.
And is it typical to release a search warrant like this?
Yes.
To the press?
Well, what typically happens is a search warrant is filed with a court. And after so many days, typically like 10 days in California, I believe, the media now can have access to that search warrant. It's public record unless the investigator tells the court it needs to be sealed. So chances are, you know, somebody in the media went to the courts and said, give it to me. And they got it.
Yeah. Okay. Another thing that I'm noticing on here is that we've heard that they left the bar at 9:30. This document is saying that they left the bar at 10:30, which shrinks the window even more. So I think, you know, I think the biggest question that I have right now is, did they move? You know, did they try to move campsites in the middle of the night?
Sure. Sure.
So with no leads, the FBI and state authorities began to help with the investigation. And on the 9th, the sheriff said they believe the killer fled the area after killing the women. I'm not sure that they could, how they could say that this was the case, that the killer had fled and there was no, the public weren't in danger. I don't know why that they were able to do that, but Crystal and Kylan's case didn't gain much attention at first. It had been on our radar, but we were still digging into it. And then just last week, their name started coming up again because of a different case that had a strong connection, at least location-wise. Now, this is the case of Gabby Pepito. We aren't going to go into every little detail of it, and there's more information coming out daily. We're recording this on a Wednesday, and by when you're listening to this on Monday, there might be a whole new chapter on this case. We're going to talk about Gabby's case. 22-year-old Gabby Pepito met her boyfriend, 23-year-old Brian Laundrie, on Long Island, New York, when they were both at Bayport Blue Point High School. In 2020, the couple moved to Northport, Florida to live with Brian's mom, and in July of 2020, the two were engaged. Earlier in the year, the couple had taken their first cross-country road trip together. At the time, they traveled in a Nissan Sentra, and they loved traveling and decided to downsize their lives so they could travel more, so they bought this camper van. And during the summer, Gabby and Brian went to Long Island to visit family, and they left on July 2nd to start their next cross-country road trip. And they were going to chronicle this trip on their Instagram and YouTube accounts. And this was going to be like what they were going to be like. They were going to be adventure bloggers.
Their first stop was July 4th at Monument Rocks in Kansas. Next, they stopped in Colorado on the 10th. Then they spent the rest of July starting on the 18th in Utah. They visited Zion National Park, Bryce Canyon National Park, Mystic Hot Springs, and Canyonlands. On August 12th, they made it to Moab, Utah. It was the day before Crystal and Kylan were last seen. Gabby and Brian visited Arches National Park. At 4:30 p.m. that day, a witness called in a domestic incident. The witness said the couple were fighting over a phone and they saw Brian slap Gabby inside the van. The incident happened right outside of Moonflower Cooperative, where Kylan worked. 15 minutes after the call, law enforcement spotted the white Ford Transit van near National Park. It was going 45 in a 15-mile-per-hour zone. A traffic stop was conducted. The van hit a curb before it stopped. When the officer approached the vehicle, Brian was driving. Gabby was crying uncontrollably in the passenger seat. Both Brian and Gabby gave the officer the same story. They admitted to the argument outside of Moonflowers. According to Brian on the body cam footage, he told Gabby he needed space, but she didn't want to leave him. Then she began slapping him. That's when Brian grabbed her face and pushed her back. Brian said he then jumped in the van, trying to lock all the doors so he could leave Gabby. But he didn't lock the driver's side door. She opened it and crawled over him to the passenger seat. Their stories differ a little in regard to the traffic stop. Gabby said she saw the police car and punched Brian's arm to get his attention. According to her, the punch caused him to swerve and hit the curb. Brian, however, said Gabby grabbed the wheel.
Now, during the entire interaction, Gabby was crying. Brian seemed calm, but he did have scratches on his face and arm. The couple begged the police not to arrest either of them, and law enforcement agreed as long as they would separate for the evening. Brian was set up with a hotel room in the area, and Gabby left with the van. There wasn't any activity again on their social media accounts until August 19th. On that day, the couple posted a video on YouTube about their van life. The two were seen kissing in the van, rock climbing, and laughing. On August 24th, Gabby FaceTimed her family from Salt Lake City. The couple was still in Utah. She told them they were leaving Utah and headed for Wyoming. Now, Paul, with this traffic stop, a lot has come out there, and a lot of people have been analyzing this via the body cam of what was going on. We know that the person who called 911 said he saw a man hitting a woman, but it seems like once the cops got there, Gabby is saying, no, I was hitting him. It also seemed like there was a couple moments there. He's very, you know, he calls her crazy when asked if she's on medication. He says that, you know, in a joking way, but that's not cool. He says that at one point he says that he doesn't take a water because water has plastic, the plastic water bottle, and he drinks out of melon rinds, but she takes the water. So who knows what was going on there? There's just a lot of sort of kind of controlling aspects that could be looked into for this relationship at the moment.
Yeah, you know, given the circumstances, you know, you have this recorded on the body cam, but you know, considering that you have visible injuries, I mean, Brian has visible injuries. Gabby's crying. I don't know if she had any visible injuries on her face where Brian grabbed her. But fundamentally, at least in California, when you have this circumstance, I mean, there has to be an arrest that is made. You know, this is one of those fundamental aspects of dealing with domestic violence, is that if a victim, whether it be a male or female, has a complaint and or visible injury due to the interactions, then there is going to be an arrest. So here they beg law enforcement, don't arrest anybody, and law enforcement backs off. I don't know what Utah's, you know, standards are, but this is something where, you know, could there have been, you know, a kind of an intercession, if that's the right term,
yeah,
to have prevented, you know, Gabby going missing and then ultimately ending up dead. If they acted on the DV that was occurring, that was recorded, and there was visible injuries.
Yeah, and it's the fact that it happened right outside of the Moonflower, which is, and the timing when it happened too, obviously people were going to put these together and say maybe there was something connected to it, because Krystal and Kylan's murders and this incident happening so close to, really right outside of Kylan's work.
Yeah, you know, that's just such a, I mean, if it's coincidence, that's a crazy coincidence. And I've seen crazy coincidences. However, it's, okay, you have, in essence, a double homicide, and you have, and then you have this DV incident where the female ends up dead, you know, happening basically in the same area at the same time. You have to consider the possibility that there's some relationship between these cases.
And, You know, I actually worked a story in Moab, Utah. It was these two brothers who were Eagle Scouts who went looking for the body of a missing fugitive and were able to find it. And, you know, so we went through all the canyons and the spider holes and all that. I can't tell you how, especially when you get out into the wilderness out there, how quiet it is and how you don't really see anything. You don't see any animals or anything. You might see a bird up in the sky, but it's that kind of quiet that makes you think like you can't hear because there's literally nothing there. It's like you're living in some sort of a weird vacuum.
Right, right. Well, you know, I take my Jeep out into the middle of nowhere and that's the type of thing I experience. And it's, you know, it's that famous phrase, you know, if a tree falls in a forest, does any, is a sound made, yeah. Right? Gabby's mom received a few more texts from her daughter until the 30th. But according to the New York Times, her mother is unsure if Gabby was the one who sent them. Gabby posted on Instagram on August 25th for the last time. Then on the 30th, her mom received one last text message telling her, no service in Yosemite. 2 days after that text, Gabby's fiancé Brian returned home to Northport, Florida. The drive from Yosemite to Northport is 41 hours. He was driving the van, but Gabby wasn't with him. With no word from Gabby for over 10 days, her parents reported her missing on September 11th. Then the media storm began. Law enforcement tried to speak with Brian, but he refused to be available for an interview and hired an attorney. Police described him as a person of interest in Gabby's disappearance. Despite law enforcement reaching out directly to Brian's attorney, he would not do an interview. His attorney instead said, intimate partners are often the first person law enforcement focus their attention on in cases like this, and the warning that any statement made will be used against you is true, regardless of whether my client had anything with Miss Petito's disappearance.
Yeah, so this is really where everybody's antennas raised. Obviously, you don't, this guy didn't care at this point. Remember, this is where we were at this time. We had heard that he had come back. We had heard that she was not with him. And we heard that he was not talking to the police, not giving them any information. So we have no idea if, you know, the couple was separate. We don't even have any idea if she really had texted on the 30th saying no service in Yosemite to her mom.
Right.
We don't know anything. And, 2 days after that text, Brian comes home. That's a 41-hour trip. I don't know if he would do it all in one shot, but, you know, that's pretty rough right there.
Well, it is, you know, and if, let's say, Gabby, as far as Brian knew, was just missing. You know, they got into a fight. He's like, yeah, I'm out of here. And he takes the van and drives off. You know, the reality is that at this point, you're not dealing with a crime. So why isn't Brian just saying, hey, you know, I left her, you know, back on, you know, whatever, Route I-70 at this location. Go look there, you know, but we got into a fight and she's on her own. She's an adult. Mm-hmm. And she can care for herself. But the fact that he goes straight for an attorney and just shuts down, you know, as an investigator, you go, okay, you know, this becomes very apparent that he is concerned that he is going to be looked at for something more than just getting into a fight with his girlfriend and driving off.
Yeah. And if he wanted to help, because he could have done this, he could have said, I last saw her here and that was the last time, and then shut up.
Yeah.
You can say something and then shut up. You're allowed to do that.
No, absolutely.
So, while still trying to talk to Brian, the National Park Service and the FBI began to search the Grand Teton National Park for Gabby. Now, that was the last confirmed location that they had with social media. Meanwhile, Gabby's parents began to beg publicly for Brian to say where he left their daughter. Then on the 17th, the case took another twist. Brian's parents told law enforcement they hadn't seen Brian since the 14th, and they pointed to the Carlton Reserve. Law enforcement was now searching for Brian and Gabby in two different parts of the country. During the searches, Utah Sheriff said they did not believe Gabby's case was related to Crystal and Kylene's murder. So that's like really the first time that they kind of addressed that. So while they're searching for Gabby, a lot of citizen detectives jumped into the fray, and YouTubers and TikTok users may have actually helped authorities with not only their timeline, but with locations. And on YouTube, these YouTubers, Jen and Kyle Bethune, they were on their own trip to Grand Teton and they were taking video, and they had passed by a van that was Gabby's van. Now, also on TikTok, a woman named Miranda Baker said she gave Brian a ride when he was hitchhiking on 829 in Grand Teton. So, you know, taking a look at where that van was located, and a lot of people have looked at the images of that van, and you can see possibly that there are flip-flops there. There's even talk of that you could see somebody digging a hole behind the van. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, whether you're seeing it or not, whether it's shadows or not, a lot of people are talking about it. So we definitely wanted to, you know, the police haven't confirmed it, but we definitely wanted to bring it up. So there was a lot of things going on social media because this became a really, really big case. Probably the biggest social media true crime case, I would say, since Delphi. When you think about it.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because I did not know about this case until I started having news media outlets reaching out to me to make live comments. And I hadn't followed it. So I was like, well, I can't comment on anything I know nothing about. But it's obviously, you know, it's gotten a lot of attention, and it has gotten stranger and stranger as more details come out.
Yeah. And it's one of those things also as well. We had talked about, and I want to address this, the missing white woman syndrome, in that the media and law enforcement only focusing on the pretty white girl versus all of these missing persons of color. And here is the situation as I see it. It's not an either or. You should be doing both, obviously. And, you know, the one thing that we need to put pressure on is not so much the media, believe me, and I've been in those rooms. I've been in a room with TV producers saying, I want to do this story. And they said no. And I know the reason why they said it. And it was because it was a person of color. And then you fight for it. And that's the whole reason why we actually do this podcast now, is because it's basically saying, screw you, TV. But the producers are going to be like that. TV is going to be like that. Media is going to be like that. They're getting better. It's really, really slow. Law enforcement are the ones that really need to be put their, you know, feet to the fire. You know, we did the story about Jelani Day last week, talking about how, you know, this kid goes missing in the wilderness. They find his car there. Kind of similar stuff, but, you know, we didn't see this big outpouring of searches. I'm not talking about media, but actually searches and equipment and vehicles and all that stuff. We didn't see that with JJ's case as we saw it with Gabby's case. Doesn't mean it should be one or the other, but both should be done at the same time.
Well, there really needs to be, you know, a standardized approach in terms of resources, you know, dictated by, you know, the context of the case, you know, regardless of who the victim is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, Paul, now we also have the person of interest that goes missing. How is that going to affect the investigation? Because we know that, you know, his parents just pointed over to this, these preserves. There's talk that he might have gone to Cuba, that he is a kind of a survivalist type of guy that could hang out in the woods for a long time. So where do police go from here now?
Well, you know, right now they're just labeling him as a person of interest, which is really, it's an odd term in my opinion. You know, this is a term that is often used in the online community, but rarely used within my law enforcement circles. Either the person's a suspect or not. Just because a person's, I mean, you have suspects that are very strong suspects, and you have suspects that are, well, you know, there's something suspicious about why we think they may be involved, but they're not very strong, you know, and obviously, you know, with Brian, you know, he's a strong suspect. I wouldn't water this down at all, especially with what we know in terms of what ultimately, you know, has happened with Gabby. You know, he goes missing. This is just furtherance of any investigator going, okay, this appears to indicate that he is trying to either maintain his freedom by, you know, separating himself from being able to be found by law enforcement, or there is, you know, the the remorse, my life is done based on what I've done. And yeah, he's, you know, taken his life out in the middle of nowhere. You know, but fundamentally, law enforcement is got to make a case as to who, you know, as to what happened to Gabby, and then ultimately who killed Gabby.
Mm-hmm. So on Sunday, September 19th, remains were discovered in the area of Spread Creek Dispersed Camping Area. It's located in Bridger Teton National Forest on the eastern line of Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming. And the area is remote, surrounded by lakes and mountains and trails. The body was Gabby's. The autopsy of the remains took place on Tuesday, September 21st. The manner of death has been ruled a homicide. Cause of death has not been released. And law enforcement is still continuing to search for Brian. Now, Paul, how difficult will it be for them to build a case against Brian if they do find him, or even if they don't find him, and then they're able to do it? I mean, there's, you know, he did the things that you always hear about that you're supposed to do, which is lawyer up and not talk to anybody. But the way that he did it was so shifty. The previous domestic assault situation, everything points to this guy being guilty. But where's the proof going to be?
Yeah, you know, well, obviously, you know, from a making a case, the relationship between Brian and Gabby is going to most certainly complicate the physical evidence aspects, because just, you know, typically when you have, let's say, a stranger as an offender, you know, the mere presence of that offender's DNA or latents or other identifying or associative evidence becomes significant. But with Brian, most of the things that law enforcement would be using could be explained through just because they have an ongoing relationship. They're riding around in a vehicle together. So now it's looking for the evidence of violence, you know, mm-hmm. the blood spatter, blood patterns, other aspects. You know, we don't know what the cause of death is. And I think law enforcement is very smart not to release that. They probably have asked the coroner's office to seal that information, because the physical evidence is mitigated by Brian's relationship with Gabby. So it's now mm-hmm. going to come down to an interview, if he ever gives statements. And if he makes statements that are lining up with the facts of what happened to Gabby, then that's incriminating, you know, and so that would be something that could be used against him. But the chances of Brian ever giving statements now that he's lawyered up are almost zero to none. And yeah, so this really complicates, you know, the law enforcement and the prosecutors from building a case in order to get that, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt proof. So it is tough, but it's not impossible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Brian's actions potentially can be used against him. A good prosecutor can find a way to get that into court if they're proven to be relevant to the case itself.
And you have to also think that that van is being gone over with a fine-tooth comb to try and find anything of the violent variety, blood variety, or something like that that could match up.
Yeah. You know, the van, the campsites, you know, that you have, so that, you know, where her remains were found, you know, any place in between from their last known location to where her remains are found, there's going to be so much. You know, and technology, you know, video surveillance on freeways or at campsites, whether it be government-based or private citizen-based, you know, showing, let's say, the van, you know, driving, you know, in that night to where her body was found. You know, those mm-hmm. things are potentially out there that law enforcement can get access to build a case and say, yes, we believe that Brian is her killer. And, you know, it's just, if he had nothing to do with her homicide, you know, the best thing from all angles is for him to say, this is my last known interaction with her, and I left and she was alive, you know, and then let's see where the investigation goes. But all of his actions after she goes missing just seem to cement the idea that he has some involvement in her homicide.
And you also have to think, too, that they're checking any gas station footage along the way, any highway stuff along the way. If he went to the gas station, did he go wash up? There's a lot of stuff there. And, you know, luckily, you know, we're still within the 30-day time period because a lot of times these get wiped. At least at the time that we're talking about this, a lot of times these have a life of 30 days for when you're checking them. So hopefully they're checking everywhere between where her body was found and Florida.
Well, and you know, and that's one of the advantages, because the FBI is involved in this case. They have that's really where the FBI shines, is the manpower that they have across the nation. You know, they can send agents out from multiple locations, you know, along any route that, you know, Gabby's body may have been taken, or Gabby and Brian drove, and, you know, just find footage, you know.
Yeah. So. No, hopefully. And, you know, obviously we started this episode too, focusing on Crystal and Kylan's case. And hopefully, you know, the attention that is being shown on Moab can also shine a light on their case, which had a little bit of noise, but also, you know, completely obviously got swallowed up by this case. And, you know, before we get into the weekly assignment, we wanted to bring another missing persons case that hasn't gotten much attention, but a lot of people have forwarded to us, and we wanted to tell you about it. 24-year-old Daniel Robinson, he's a field geologist, and he moved to Phoenix, Arizona after he graduated from college. Many of the sites he oversaw were in the remote desert. On June 23rd, 2021, Daniel was seen driving his blue Jeep Renegade near Sun Valley Parkway and Cactus Road. No one knew where he was going. When Daniel hadn't contacted anyone, he was reported missing. The Buckeye Police Department conducted air and land searches. The searches covered 70 square miles, and they used UTVs and cadaver dogs and drones. Nearly a month later, on July 19th, Daniel's Jeep was actually discovered, and it had significant damage. A landowner found it 4 miles southwest of Daniel's last job site. It was in a ravine, and it had rolled and landed on its side, and the airbags had actually deployed. Inside the Jeep were Daniel's clothes, cell phone, wallet, and keys. And according to Arizona Central, the state of Daniel's Jeep has led them to believe foul play is not suspected, but his location is still unknown. So I think what they're thinking is that he had an accident, possible head injury, stumbled out, possibly. You know, his family has made a petition with the hopes that the Buckeye Police Department be held accountable, because Daniel's father believes law enforcement is not doing their job to find his son. He hopes the police will actually consider a criminal investigation into Daniel's disappearance, believing the crash site may have been staged. Now, I mean, it's always going to be difficult when you have a seemingly a one-car crash in the middle of nowhere. And this really is, much like we're talking about outside of Moab, you know, Buckeye, you're kind of in the middle of nowhere out here. And, you know, a lot of people have written in about this case, and also because it's kind of also very similar to Jelani Day's case. So we wanted to get this on everybody's radar.
Yeah, you know, and for me, his Jeep holds a lot of the clues, including the computer, you know. So hopefully they've brought in, you know, some traffic reconstruction experts, guys that know how to, you know, download the information out of that Jeep's computer. You know, how fast was it traveling at the time, you know, it crashed? You know, is there anything to indicate that, you know, it had just merely been pushed off versus it looks like it is a true accident? You know, get all the information you can out of the one piece of real evidence that you have, and then go from there.
Yeah. So that's going to bring us to our weekly assignment. 38-year-old Crystal Turner and 24-year-old Kylan Schulte were last seen at Woody's Tavern having drinks. They left around 10:30 or 9:30. We're not quite sure. Weren't seen alive again. A family friend discovered them at their campsite on August 19th. Each of the women were nude and had been shot multiple times. And they had been talking about a creeper guy who had been in that park. So anybody who's ever actually, you know, stayed out in that area, in that neck of the woods, and remembers a creeper guy, and anything that you could talk about that guy, that's something that, you know, write into us. It sounds, you know, there's no real other information, but, you know, think about creeper guys is they leave impressions on people. So maybe there's a chance that, that we might be able to, identify something about this guy. Of course, you know, as of this moment, we're still looking for Brian Laundrie. Who knows where he is? And, you know, there's debates on the internet whether this guy has killed himself yet or if he's too much of a narcissist to even do that. We'll keep you updated on that, obviously. And then the missing person we brought you at the end was Daniel Robinson, and he was last seen June 23rd in the area of Sun Valley Parkway and Cactus Road. His car was located a month later with his belongings inside. Daniel is 5'8 with black hair and brown eyes, and he's missing his right forearm and hand. So, you know, a lot of cases, a lot of things that are going on right now in the true crime community, but we're going to keep on getting answers. We did get a lot of good answers last week. It was a big week for true crime with Robert Durst, you know, being found guilty, Faith Hedgepeth arrest in her case, and then an arrest in the Murdaugh case as far as him allegedly setting up his own suicide. So, you know, we want to really keep the ball rolling on this stuff. That takes us to the rules. Again, if you know a creepy guy, don't just post a picture of him and his Instagram account. Send it to us. We'll work on it. No side-by-sides, no names in public. Be nice to each other. Don't dox each other. And that takes us to the weekly distraction. Paul, what's distracted you this week?
You know, I'm kind of going back and forth about what I want to talk about, to be frank. You know, I'm kind of in between some work-related stuff, and so I've been focusing in on my aquarium, trying to get that set up a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And I've added some more livestock into the aquarium. But one of the most fascinating aspects, and I will just sit in front. I've got a stool that I will put in front of the aquarium, and I'll have a drink, and I will just watch, you know, these animals inside the tank. And for me, it's almost like it's better than TV. But, you know, some of these animals form these really fascinating symbiotic relationships where they help each other out. And mm-hmm. I ended up getting what's called a yellow watchman goby and a tiger pistol shrimp. And these two very different creatures will literally bond. And the shrimp, this pistol shrimp, which it's known as a pistol shrimp because it has one large claw that it can close super fast to a point where, I mean, it can kill prey with it, but it also makes a very loud crack, almost sounds like a mm-hmm. gunshot inside the tank. But it's like this very industrious house cleaner. It sits there and burrows in the sand and is constantly bulldozing sand out to make a home for the goby. And the mm-hmm. goby benefits from this pistol shrimp because it gets a home, but the shrimp benefits from the goby because the goby can see, whereas the shrimp has very poor eyesight. So this goby, it's a watchman goby, just sits outside the home looking for predators. And okay. as the shrimp always has an antenna on the goby's tail. And if the goby, you know, shakes its tail a certain way, the shrimp immediately goes underneath the home. And so they benefit. And of course there's food and stuff, but it's so cool to watch nature at work. And it's a little world that I have built. So I'm loving it. And it's just only going to get more fascinating as this tank grows up.
Now, do you feel like you're some sort of a deity as you're watching this world that you built?
Yeah, maybe a little, you know, because I will sit there and I'll watch a fish, you know, pick on another fish. And I'm like, you better watch yourself. You know, I will change your life if you.
Yeah,
if
the wrath of God will come in the form of the.
That's right. You will be isolated. You will go into the other tank.
The pistol shrimp. Yeah, I didn't know there was a pistol. I know that there's a basketball team, women's basketball team in Los Angeles called the Pistol Shrimps. But I
really?
Did not know that there
oh.
was. Yes, I
did oh,
not
yeah.
know that there was a.
Well, yep. believe so. It or not, when I was researching pistol shrimps, the loudest natural sound on Earth is from a pistol shrimp colony under the ocean because they're yeah. all popping their claws. And I guess it's deafening. I mean, it's like 140 decibels, louder than a jet engine.
Wow. Wow. Well, I've been staring at a screen of some sorts. This month is so boring compared to yours. I'm rewatching the Avengers series. And I really do, you know, as much as I grew up a DC kid, you know, I was always more into Batman.
Okay.
And Superman and Wonder Woman and the Justice League. But, you know, they did such a great job with they could have really messed it up, but they did such a great job with Avengers of really getting you to really love the characters. And I have a hard, you know, you always like to pick your favorite character. I have a hard time picking my favorite character when it comes to the Avengers. You know, I love Ant-Man because he's funny, you know, and I love, you know, just the sort of, you know, the dry, cynical wit of Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man.
Yeah.
You know, the eternal optimism of Captain America, you know, the sort of slyness and smarts of Black Widow, the guy with the bow and arrow and everything else. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's, that's what I've been doing now. I put it on, because also I can't work out with nothing on the TV too, because I'm a child.
Well, you know, I'll say, you know, I think my favorite character, if I'm in the right universe here, is the Hulk.
Yes.
And in part because I watched the original Hulk series with Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno as the Hulk, you know, as a kid, as I was growing up. But then one of the funniest moments I've ever seen in the movies, where I was laughing so hard I was tearing up, and my older kids thought I was, you know, crazy. They bring it up as a story, was, and I don't know which one, it may have been the first Avengers, but it's when the Hulk grabs Loki.
Yes.
And just body slams him over and over and over again.
No, because Loki is dialoguing and he's going, "I am a god. You are a puny human." And then Hulk just grabs him and then just throws him back and forth and back and forth.
It's like, I don't give a shit who you are. I'm going to show you who I am. I loved it.
Yes.
Yep.
All right. That's excellent. All right. Well, there you go. Steven, who's your favorite Marvel character?
All right. Well, I'm going to have to go with Scarlet Witch obviously she's been in the later Avengers movies, but also this year's WandaVision. She just has such an interesting story that I'm glad we got to see her, more of in the TV show.
Yes. And Polly?
I'm a Black Widow person. Consistently. Okay. She's, you know, the red hair, badass, slightly smart ass, right up my alley.
Slightly smart ass. You're very smart ass.
I was talking about the character, not me.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. I gotcha.
Okay.
All right. Well, everybody, thank you so much. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Go buy some merch. We also have some new stuff coming up. And until then, keep digging.
And don't be an irony. Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Paulie Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgariff, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.